I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned in to Modus Operandi. Tonight, we'll cruise over to the Pacific Rim. While much of the world has its eyes on Ukraine, the U.S. Department of Defense and Washington's political elite have already shifted their gaze farther east. Taiwan, Australia, the Philippines, the Solomon Islands, Washington is island hopping. And we'll tell you why next. All right, let's get into the MO. They've told you flat out that their focus is shifting to the Pacific. Remember when President Joe Biden said this?
Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's the commitment we made. That's the commitment we made. We are not. Look, here's the situation. We agree with a one China policy. We signed on to it and all the attendant agreements made from there. But the idea that it can be taken by force, just taken by force, is just not appropriate. It will dislocate the entire region and be another action similar to what happened in Ukraine.
That was Biden back in 2022 while on his first trip to Asia as POTUS during a press conference in Japan with his counterpart Fumio Kishida. And while Washington keeps saying it observes the one China policy, their actions tell you another story. Look at Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan just before she stepped down as Speaker of the House, or technically the third in line to the presidency. As they say, talk is cheap. The Chinese know this, so they're taking action across the Pacific region. They've expanded their new Belt and Road Initiative to include maritime deals, which will increase trade partnerships throughout much of the Pacific Rim. So here to break it all down for us is an expert in U.S.-China relations. He has lived and worked in mainland China on and off since the 1980s. Dr. Ken Hammond, professor of history at New Mexico State University. He's also the former director of the Confucius Institute and author of the new book, China's Revolution and the Quest for a Socialist Future. Dr. Hammond, thank you so much for joining us today. First question, in the Pacific region, there is really only one major country that is considered Western. That's Australia. Sorry, New Zealand. But we saw increased tensions between the Chinese and Aussies under the Morrison government. But now that Labor has won down under, Anthony Albanese is making moves to thaw the icy relations between his country and China. But the elephant in the room for Albanese is the U.S. Between the new Biden-AUKUS pact, the Quad Security Alliance, the Aussies could be hamstrung from getting too close to Beijing. How do you read Australia's fine line they're walking?
Well, I think that they're caught in a sort of historical conundrum in some ways because, of course, Australia has a long history of, as a white settler colony. It has been a participant in the British imperial system. After its independence, it has remained very closely tied to Britain. That varies from administration to administration. But I think that Labor finds itself in a situation where the reality in the world, of course, is that Asia and within Asia, China is increasingly important in terms of Australia's international trade. China is becoming much more significant, much more carrying a lot more weight. And so I think that there's this sort of legacy of identification with the West, with the British Empire, and then later with the United States. But the evolving realities, the emerging realities, are that Australia's future is probably going to be shaped more by its relationship with China. So I think that Albanese's got to navigate this very carefully. I think that it's a welcome situation now for Australia to be backing away from some of the more overt antagonism and some of the deeper engagement with America's, imperial ambitions. But I think he also is probably keeping one eye at least on the recollection of what happened with Gough Whitlam and a previous Labor government that was essentially taken out by the United States for being too progressive at home. And given the focus that the United States has on opposing China now, he has to be careful not to become too friendly to China, you know, at the risk of provoking some sort of either overt or clandestine intervention by the United States that could challenge his political viability.
Now, despite Aussie MPs calling this thaw with China, quote, a stabilization of ties rather than a reset, trade between these two states have been booming since their WTO spat over barley tariffs that the Chinese imposed during the pandemic. Australia's exports to China surged to record highs back in this March, accounting for $12.71 billion U.S. dollars. That's up 31% from the year before. The Chinese have purchased huge volumes of iron ore and coal from Australia, lifting their ban on Aussie coal earlier this year. Now, some in the West are suspicious of Beijing's new purchases from Canberra, accusing China of sort of buying their way into diplomacy. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that that's a pretty self-serving interpretation. I mean, really, what's going on in the world as a whole is that there's this sort of deep structural reconfiguration of the global economy taking place, that the monopoly that was held by the sort of North Atlantic core, Western Europe and North America, since the Industrial Revolution, you know, on the modern technologies of production that allowed them to reconfigure the world in a way that was focused on them and subordinated everybody else to being either sources of raw materials or markets for manufactured goods. That era is over. You know, productive technologies have been diffused around the world in various ways. And countries like China, but not only China, are now not only sort of catching up with modern production from the West, but innovating and creating new technologies on their own. And so we've moved beyond that period, not just the period of Western colonialism and Western imperialism, but the domination of the economy by those core countries in the West. So that's just a deep changing reality. And what that means is that trade with China for a country like Australia, which has, you know, commodities that China needs and wants and has things that it wants to buy from China, this is just a logical development. And for that to be a growing component of Australia's economy, Australia's international trade, it's just common sense. And so to look at it sort of cynically and say, oh, the Chinese are bribing the Australians, that's really just silly. It's simply a manifestation of the changing realities of a now emergent multipolar world, where the United States and its allies in Western Europe are no longer the dominant center, you know, but it's something that they're not happy about, the Americans and their allies. But this is just a change that's going to take place. This is going to continue to unfold as the years and decades from now go forward. And Australia, I think, will do best for itself if it tries to pursue a path that allows it to profit, in a sense, from that change, you know, find its own position within this new multipolar world, rather than just tying its fortunes to, you know, the continuing dominance of the United States.
Another battleground in the Pacific is the tiny Solomon Islands. Australia is their closest mainland neighbor, nearly 1,000 miles away, but some on that island are asking them to intervene as a Chinese state-owned company is negotiating right now a deal to buy a deep-water seaport and a World War II airstrip from Honiara. China is already the island's main revenue source, with 90% of extractive resources going to Beijing. Despite assurances by the Prime Minister, Manasseh Sogavare, that China will not, quote, have any military bases on the islands, there's still a lot of distrust there, especially given that the Solomon Islands abandoned their 36-year support for Taiwan in favor of Beijing. The U.S. has recently reopened their embassy there to boot. So why are there so many eyes on the Solomon Islands right now?
Well, I think that the shifting situation in the Pacific region is a story that's developing. It's a very dynamic situation right now. The Solomon Islands, not I think because of some particular circumstance of their location or anything like that, but because they have been kind of in the forefront of recognizing this changing world that we were just talking about. You know, I think that for them to shift their diplomatic recognition from Taipei to Beijing, it's just a logical step again in adapting to the emerging realities of the 21st century. I think it's a very pragmatic step. I don't think that the government in the Solomon Islands is particularly ideologically oriented one way or another between the United States and China, but I think that they're looking at the economics of their country. They're looking at a very challenging future with global warming and rising sea levels and all this. They have many things they're going to have to be dealing with. And I think the idea that China is somehow looking to establish some sort of military base in the Solomon Islands is again, it's an example of the kind of projection that Western, especially American politicians and elites, you know, do with China. That, of course, the United States has hundreds of bases in countries all around the world, including all over the Pacific. China has one military installation outside of its own borders, and that's in Djibouti in East Africa, and it's part of a United Nations anti-piracy initiative. It's located exactly next door to an American base that, at least in part, is involved in the same operation. So that's China's one military establishment outside of its own borders. But wherever they're involved in a lot of these development projects, especially when seaports are involved, we hear this about Sri Lanka, we hear this about Cambodia, we hear this about various African countries, the immediate suspicion is, oh, they're going to be establishing, you know, military bases. But there's no history of China doing that. China's one great venture in maritime exploration and all that way back in the early 15th century didn't involve taking over other countries or setting up colonies or anything like that. It was simply sort of a diplomatic flag waving, you know, here we are kind of series of expeditions. So, you know, I think that the Solomon Islands, you know, I don't know, maybe they're benefiting a little bit from all the attention. Maybe I think we see that the United States reopening the embassy, you know, they're going to try and maintain some of their influence there. But I think that you know, they're simply adjusting quite rationally and reasonably and pragmatically to this evolving situation in the world.
Yes, I think you are right. I think it's important to highlight that the U.S. is the country with the most foreign bases all around the world. History, of course, is very telling. Okay, doctor, we got to leave it, pause it right there. Coming up next, we'll get into Taiwan. That appears to be the trigger word for the Biden administration. We'll discuss it when we return with Dr. Ken Hammond. Sit tight, the MO will be right back.
At the end of the 18th century, Great Britain began to conquer and colonize Australia. From the very beginning of the British penetration to the continent, natives were subjected to severe violence and deliberate extirpation. According to modern historians, in the first 140 years, there were at least 270 massacres of local people. Any resistance to the British was answered with doubled cruelty. Hundreds of natives were killed for the murder of one settler. Indigenous Australians were not considered complete people. No wild beast of the forest was ever hunted down with such unsparing perseverance as they are. Men, women, and children are shot whenever they can be met with. Squatter Henry Myrick wrote in a letter to his family in England in 1846, Australia's past is rightly described as blood-soaked and racist. If at the beginning of colonization there were 1.5 million indigenous people living on the continent, then by the beginning of the 20th century, their number had decreased to 100,000 people. Despite the indisputable historical facts, the problem of full recognition of the crimes of white Australians against Aborigines has not been resolved so far.
Russian state control narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays, on est en France quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Welcome back to the MO. I'm Manila Chan. You heard President Biden at the top saying the U.S. would intervene militarily should there be a confrontation between mainland China and Taiwan. Comments like this often leave his team scrambling to clean up the mess. Dr. Ken Hammond, he is back with us. He is a China expert and author of the book China's Revolution and the Quest for a Socialist Future. Thank you for staying with us, Dr. Hammond. So, as I mentioned, the U.S. Embassy is once again fired up in the Solomon Islands after being shuttered back in the 90s. But another Pacific island is seeing increased U.S. presence. That's the Philippines. Under newly minted President Ferdinand Marcos Jr., who, by the way, goes by the nickname Bongbong. I did not make that up. He goes by Bongbong. President Bongbong has agreed to allow the U.S. to build 4 new military installations on the island, bringing that total up to 9 bases. If you're Beijing, doesn't this look to you like the George Kennan philosophy of containing the Soviet Union, but Pacific style?
Well, it is. I mean, it doesn't just look like that. That's what it is. You know, back in 2011, when President Obama announced the American pivot to Asia. This is exactly what he was talking about. He, you know, talked about the redeployment of American military assets and military resources and intelligence resources to this exact mission. You know, to they can't, you know, entirely encircle China because of its you know, landward frontiers in Eurasia. But as far as the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, that's the whole idea, is to establish this kind of at least half ring around China for military operations, for intelligence gathering, for, you know, carrying out various kinds of clandestine activities that we've seen the effects of over time. You know, the establishment of these bases and the existing bases and bases in many other countries, that is exactly a new version of containment. And again, you know, it's in the from the perspective of American politicians and American elites and media and all that, this is just business as usual. Of course, it's perfectly fine for the United States to go out and have these bases all around in the world. You know, Secretary of State Clinton, back in the Obama administration, published a foreign, I think it was in Foreign Affairs article, about the call for a new American Pacific Century, this idea that the Pacific is sort of our turf. And you know, so we can just do whatever we want out there. And you know, China is not necessarily directly challenging that, but it doesn't acknowledge or accept that and goes about its own business. And the U.S. is trying to counteract that, trying to contain China, trying somehow to, I don't know, derail this this reconfiguration of global relations. And I think that's pretty much a fool's errand. I think that as I say, this is a deep historical process. It's not something that is going to be offset, certainly at this stage in the game. So you know, there's a sort of cognitive gap between this fantasy that somehow China is establishing bases or doing this, which doesn't hold up, and the reality of America's continued projection of power wherever it can around the world.
So obviously Taiwan is the main island of contention here in the Pacific. The U.S. says it recognizes the one China policy on diplomatic documents, but Washington's rhetoric and actions seem to allude to another philosophy altogether relative to China. We've heard some very provocative language from the U.S. side, you know, everyone from Navy admirals to President Biden himself. Even outright diplomatic disregard when then Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi took a trip to Taipei last year against the wishes of Beijing. What do you think is going to happen with Taiwan?
Well, I wish I knew. Yeah, obviously, it's a very tumultuous situation right now, and I think a very dangerous one right now. I think that, you know, there is a clear record of hypocrisy on the part of the United States here, because in repeated communiques and agreements over the years, beginning with President Nixon's visit way back in 1972, you know, the United States has committed itself to acknowledging and recognizing that people on both sides of the strait understand that you know, the Taiwan is part of China. There's only one China. Taiwan is part of China. There's a disagreement between the local authorities on the island and the central government in Beijing as to who's in charge, who runs the whole country. But if you go to Taipei and buy a map and it says, you know, Republic of China, it shows the whole country. And if you go to Beijing and you buy a map, it says People's Republic of China, and it shows the same country. So, you know, that's the reality. The question is resolving this sort of leftover legacy from the 1940s, you know, from the end of the Civil War and the victory of the revolution back in 1949, when the nationalists withdrew to the island. You know, this is something that has come down, and it has been the consistent position of the government in Beijing that this is a question that has to be solved by the Chinese people on both sides of the strait, in their own way, in their own time, without outside interference. And the U.S. committed itself to reducing its military engagement with Taiwan, to you know, withdrawing its diplomatic recognition. But, you know, ironically, as Nixon's Attorney General John Mitchell used to say, watch what we do, not what we say. And when we look at America's actions, we see that they are very different from the formal legal commitments, the formal diplomatic recognition, which is extended to the government in Beijing, not just by the United States, but by, what, 182 countries around the world, the United Nations, all these international organizations. That's the reality. But the U.S., as part of its efforts to demonize China and try to derail its progress, derail its efforts to improve the livelihood of its own people, you know, perpetuates these actions that that can only be seen as provocations, as efforts to provoke China to somehow act in a way that would allow the United States to either further criticize it or, the worst case scenario, for there to be some sort of actual conflict, military conflict between between the countries. And that would be devastating for the people on Taiwan. It would be bad for the people on the mainland. It would be bad for the American people. And yet our politicians, our political leaders, and many in the media, you know, speak out over and over again with these inflammatory statements that can only undermine the process of a peaceful, stable resolution of this historical dilemma.
So the UK has just signed on to the new CPTPP, the Comprehensive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's similar to the now defunct Obama-era TPP. It's a trade pact between 11 Pacific Rim countries. There's Vietnam, there's Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, Peru, Chile, Brunei, Canada, Japan, Malaysia, and Mexico. The region is estimated to account for 54% of global economic growth in the coming decades. Some say this is this move by the UK solidifies this sort of reorientation of the global economy in the new millennia, the coming boom of the global south and multipolar world, if you will. Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, I think this is an effort by Britain to try to position itself within that emerging multipolar reality, but I think that it's problematic in some very particular ways. Because it doesn't include China, and if you're talking about the emergence of a multipolar world, you certainly would probably want to have some engagement with a country that's likely to be at least one of those centers of production and development and innovation and creativity. This is there's an old saying in Chinese about crossing the river by feeling the stones, sort of just making your way without having a really clear, what your goal and your objective is, but you don't know exactly what the way is to get there, and you have to take it sort of step by step. So, this is an ongoing process. It's a historical transformation that's going to continue to play out in the coming years and decades. Britain, has always been very closely tied to the United States, and I think it's interesting that they're taking this step and making this gesture. How substantive that will prove to be, Britain, especially after Brexit, finds itself in a very difficult situation. They've kind of burnt their bridge to the most logical center that they might have been closely connected to. So they're looking for new options. And I think, it's not a bad thing for them to be doing this, but I think that they need to adjust their sort of reality perspective and recognize that excluding China and really taking part in something which by some people at least is seen as being directed against China. I think that they need to take that into account and tread cautiously.
Dr. Ken Hammond, I got to leave it right there, unfortunately. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, that is going to do it for this episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy and current affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO.